Wait, wait, stop. That's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being, to be true to yourself and be honest with others. So today we have a guest. Our guest today is Kenny Whitecross, and Kenny and I met on a Facebook group called Addict Lives Matter, and Kenny is over a year sober. So I'm very excited to hear his story, and thank you for being on the show today with us, Kenny.
Not a problem.
Awesome, cool. And I like your name too, Kenny Whitecross. Are you famous or anything?
No, not at all.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, with a name like that, you should be famous.
Yeah.
Awesome. So tell us who you are and what brings you joy.
Well, my name's Kenny Whitecross. I'm from Edinburgh, Scotland. And what brings me joy basically is being in recovery and what that has given me back through sort of what I lost in active addiction. You know, like as in having my mum back and my wife, my wee boy, friends who don't want anything from me. They just want what's best for me. That's it. And I'm actually, to be honest with you.
Oh, that's cool. So did you lose your family when you were an addict?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I lost all my family. They basically got fed up with me. So, you know, I was in denial for a lot of years. Didn't understand the whole aspect of being powerless and unmanageable, you know, and it took me to places when I was growing up, I vowed I would never ever do, and it took me to places I vowed I would never ever go to, you know. So whenever I said I'm never going to do that, I tend to, sort of when I drew the line in the sand, I tend to have crossed that line, you know. So I never say I'm never going to pick up again. I say I don't want to pick up, you know, because I think when you say you're never going to do something, you're putting something in place to do it in the future. So, yeah.
Right. That's understandably. So you understand that now, correct, I assume?
Yeah.
It can be hard. Even with sober people, this happens where either a friend or someone in a relationship where they say, I promise I won't do it again, and then they keep doing it, even sober.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. And I mean, in Edinburgh, especially sort of, we've sort of had sort of rigorous things since the COVID sort of hit. You know, in March 2020, and a few friends of mine who are addicts have actually relapsed, you know what I mean, and went out the door. Fortunately for them, that they've got managed to get back in the door, because I mean, it's sort of said in the fellowship, you know, it's a revolving door, but there's no guarantee. Once you go out that door, there's no guarantee that you'll get back in it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So tell us about your shame, your guilt, and your fear. How are you transcending those, and how are you working on getting rid of them or transcending it?
With the shame and the guilt, I mean, obviously I'm in a 12-step fellowship, but I'm in Narcotics Anonymous, and through working the steps, it's got me a good handle on what I was actually shame and guilty about, you know, what going through the sort of the steps. And I've actually just started my step 8, which is making a list of all people I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them, you know. And so yeah, I still carry a lot of shame and guilt around them, even though sort of I go down on paper in step 4. You know, it's sort of when I'm around family and stuff like that, sort of guilt can sort of set in. Still, you know what I mean? This is 14 months down the road to be working on myself, and I know that I'm never going to stop sort of working myself. You know, once I go through the program this time, I'll go through it again. And, you know, it's sort of to the way I treated family, you know what I mean? Like, my mum, I stole from my mum money, a medication. But above that, I stole a peace of mind. You know what I mean? It was the same with my gran. And sort of towards the end, sort of, in my, like, sort of going to prison and stuff like that, I only had one family member who would still come up and visit me, and that was my granddad. And I've got a lot of shame and guilt around that. Sadly, I can't make a direct amends. I can't make a direct amends to him because he's no longer with us, but I can do it in an indirect way by not repeating the behaviours again. So, and sort of with the fear aspect, I mean, I've still got a lot of fear about using again. You know, I do know that sort of it's always just at arm's length away from you, you know, at any given time. If I'm not doing what I set out to do on a daily basis, which when I get up in the morning, I read my just for the day, I pray, I meditate, I phone my sponsor, I phone other addicts, you know, and that's sort of been a big part of my early recovery, you know, but there's still a big bit of fear around sort of, because I know what would happen if I was to pick up, you know, I would lose all the stuff that I've managed to regain in my life and stuff. So that's probably my biggest fear is that.
Well, I'm very proud of you that you've gone through 14 months of addiction, like non-addiction. And me going through other addictions myself, I can understand and feel how challenging that must have been for you. Is your feeling right now? How is your feeling different from week one to month 14?
To be honest with you, I'm still buzzing. You know, that first week that I took the long way down, you know, when I came into the fellowship, I was still on a prescription, still smoking quite a bit of weed. And I reduced down, you know, and I've done it sort of, a lot of people reduce down for prescriptions weekly. I chose to do it monthly, you know, because I think that was a safer option for myself. And when I got that first day clean, I just wanted to get a day clean, you know what I mean? And then I've just built up momentum and continued to carry on to do the same stuff as I've done since sort of day dot, you know. But luckily for myself, you know, I had a few people in the fellowship who had sort of got close to where I was reducing down off my script, and they actually had more faith in me than I had in myself at the start. You know, I think that sort of in my experience as a sort of with faith and stuff like that, that's something that grows over a period of time, you know, and it took me maybe to around the 6 or 7 month mark till I actually started to get a bit of faith. You know, I was riddled in fear up until that point, you know, but I've got good people around me. I've got a sponsor who I trust, you know, with my life. You know, I've shared all my resentments, my shame and guilt, my defects, my shortcomings, you know, and sort of that relationship being a beautiful relationship. You know, I had my own hands from sort of when I was still on maybe 40 milli meth, 50 milli methadone, and I got the sponsor that I wanted at the end of the day, so I was delighted with that.
So tell us about your childhood.
My childhood, I mean, I actually thought until I actually came in to the programme, I actually thought I had a sort of normal childhood, but see, looking back on it now, it was anything but normal. You know, I was raised in an area of Edinburgh in sort of what we call here, sort of, we call them sort of council estates, you know, and it's sort of like urbanisations within a city centre. And growing up, sort of the first, there was a lot of violence in my house. There was a lot of alcohol consumed by my mum, who brought me up, who was predominantly a single parent. But she did have sort of boyfriends and stuff like that. And I saw my mum getting beaten as a child, you know. And I think that instilled a lot of insecurities in myself and a lot of fear, anxiety. And sort of growing up in that house in Skeever, it was an okay estate at one point, but then another estate was getting knocked down to get rebuilt, so they moved people for that estate into the estate I was staying in, and of course they brought the harder drugs. And you know, I played a lot of football growing up. Well, you used to call it soccer, over here we call it football. I played a lot of soccer growing up, And that was probably my first obsession, you know, was playing football, playing soccer. I could play that from morning till night, up until sort of my, just shy of my 13th birthday, I got my first taste of sort of drugs, you know. It was through a cousin of mine. I was staying at his house and I was annoying him, I suppose, being sort of coming up 13, he was about 18 or something. So he had the bright idea. He said, "Do you want a cup of tea?" I was like, "Yeah, I'll take a cup of tea." And he spiked it with two temazepams, 20 milligrams. So, and then sent me off to the chippy. And of course, when I came back for the chippy, they had hit me, you know, and I came, "Man, what have you done to me?" And that, it's like, "Oh, I gave you a cup of temazepam." So that was sort of my start to my drug journey. And then when I was about 13, of course, sort of the cannabis came into play, drinking alcohol at the weekends with my friends, you know. And it was a sort of slow progression for myself, you know, up until sort of I hit 16. Then we started going out club to nightclubs, to under 18 clubs. And that, of course, brought in the speed and the ecstasy. And it spiraled on for there, you know. Like I say, my childhood, I was sort of lucky in a way where a lot of other people are unfortunate. I know if people's stories that I've heard in the programme when they've done shares and stuff like that, that they only had basically their parents and never had any other family members to help them. You know, I had two loving grandparents who absolutely doted on me, you know, and I could go and stay with them whenever things got rough at my mum's, you know. But I've got no sort of, I'm not ashamed of my childhood in any way, you know, because that sort of made me the person I am today. And, you know, it's only through looking at myself that I can't change yesterday, you know what I mean? That's a big thing for me since I got into recovery. Yesterday's gone. It's all about today and what I do today. Tomorrow's not happened yet, so it's try to keep it in the day, and it can be difficult, you know, because you tend to sort of make arrangements to do things next week or in 2 weeks' time. So I tend to just try and limit it to sort of keeping it in the day.
Your first encounter to drugs is when that person made you tea and gave you lorazepam. Okay, because I was going to ask you what led to that. So basically, trauma did not lead you to.
No, it was sort of obviously I was annoying him, you know, and I can't exactly remember what it was, but I was annoying him. I was starting to do his nut, and I was maybe winding him up, you know what I mean? And he was like, "That, I'm going to calm you down," you know, because I was sort of hyperactive as a child as well, you know, and sort of it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I actually got a diagnosis on that, you know. I got diagnosed with a touchy ADHD, and also I'm on the Asperger's syndrome spectrum as well. So that answered a lot of questions about sort of why I was the way I was in childhood, you know, sort of going through school. I always sort of got, you know, in every one of my report cards through primary school and secondary school was, you know, Kenny tries, but he's easily distracted, you know, and that sort of answered a lot of questions about sort of why my behaviours in the school were the way they were. And out of school, I suppose, you know what I mean? Answered a lot of questions for me.
What is Asperger?
Asperger's, it's sort of like autism.
Oh, that's what that is? It's similar or the same?
It's similar. What it is, it's like when it gets diagnosed when you're a child, it's autism. But when you get diagnosed there as an adult, I think it's Asperger's syndrome.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
But obviously, like when I was growing up, that now it's tested for, you know, and sort of all children and stuff like that. But when I was growing up, it was basically, look, he's just hyperactive, he's just hyper, he'll calm down in time, you know, and sort of, and I was taken to see sort of psychologists and stuff like that. And they just sort of, like I say, I don't think there was the tools or the understanding about the illness is what there is today, you know, because it's more and more common. You're hearing sort of people, sort of, you know, celebrities now sort of saying, you know, they've been diagnosed with the same thing. I've been diagnosed with, and it was never heard of when I was sort of growing up. You know, it's only been sort of in the last 15 years that I've sort of not heard about it more and more and more.
You are diagnosed with with Asperger. Do you, prior to being diagnosed, did you feel that you were that, or did you basically take on that identity afterwards? Like, well, is that your identity, or were you just diagnosed that?
I was diagnosed that, but I always sort of, for by being an addict and having an addict brain, I always sort of thought I was different from other kids. The way I acted, even before I put a drug into my body, the way I would obsess about things and stuff like that wasn't sort of what I would say, I'm going to say it with quotation marks in my fingers here, what normal kids sort of would do or normal sort of people would do, you know what I mean? So that I sort of believed that I was different, you know, and sort of, but didn't have a diagnosis for it. And then finally I got a diagnosis from it, because I actually went and seen about it, you know, and sort of say, look, things aren't right with me. And I went and seen a psychologist. And that took around 6 months to get the diagnosis through going to sort of weekly appointments, you know, and then to finally get that diagnosis, it sort of, like I say, it answered a lot of questions about sort of the way I was at school and sort of the way I've behaved out of school, you know, sort of, like I say, with the obsessive things. I mean, I would sit when I was a child and sort of draw on A4 bits of paper soccer stadiums, and I would just repetitively do it over and over and over again, you know. And that's one of the sort of the traits, the condition that sort of I've been diagnosed with is sort of repetitive behaviour and stuff like that. So it's sort of, and that's what's made it sort of difficult getting into recovery, because it's sort of, I've sort of got to think sort of doubly on sort of, what is that? Is that my Asperger's, or is this my disease active? You know, and it's sort of try to find that sort of balance between the two. And it's difficult, you know, sometimes, more often than not, I get it wrong. You know what I mean? And then I've got to sort of work my stuff around that, you know, and sort of, right, that's that, you know what I mean? But
why do you call it my disease, or why do you think the science call it using drugs a disease?
Well, I think sort of, I mean, I had a problem with that word when I first came into Narcotics Anonymous. I was like, disease, it's not a disease. And it was someone that actually broke it down for me. He was like that to give me a better understanding of it. He was like that. You break into two, dis-ease, which means you're not at ease, you know. And that sort of helped me along the way, because I mean, I've no doubt that, I mean, addiction doesn't discriminate, you know what I mean? And obviously sort of, you know, your sort of psychologists and stuff like that, they didn't sort of recognise it as a disease. Certainly in the UK they don't, you know. I don't know what it's like over in the States, you know, but it's more sort of like, well, go to treatment, that'll fix you, you know what I mean, or go and do that, that'll fix you, where there's no, I mean, if they actually were to take the time to read the cards that get read out at sort of every meeting, whether it be Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or the other fellowship, CA, Cocaine Anonymous, or whatever it stands for, you know, it says it in the sort of the thing, we suffer from a disease from which there's no known cure, you know, and that to me sort of says it all. You know, like, sort of, my understanding, sort of, especially the way the world works and stuff like that, is sort of everybody should have a 12-step program in their life. It would probably make the world a better place.
I say that many times. Totally agree. Because I've seen the transformation that a 12 steps does to someone who's in recovery. And yeah. So if they apply that at school, maybe at the on 12th grade, fifth or 12th yeah. grade, then no, not 12th, I'm sorry, sixth grade.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. So how do you feel currently about the word addict and about the word recovery?
Well, the word addict, I mean, I'm comfortable with the fact, you know, that I am an addict. I've got acceptance around that. You know, I firmly believe I was an addict. I mean, I believe that the drugs were just a symptom for what I suffer from, which is a disease of addiction, you know, and the drugs are just a symptom of that. So I'm comfortable around, so to call myself an addict, I've got no problem with that. And as it being in recovery, I mean, being in recovery is sort of the best thing I've done for myself. And I've got sort of no problem sort of telling people, you know, especially people that I sometimes bump into in the street and they try and offer me drugs and stuff like that. I say, look, no thanks, I'm in recovery today. So I've got no problem sort of expressing it, and I'm comfortable with both, you know, both sides of it, you know, sort of the addict is who I am, and it's the recovery stuff that sort of I do to keep my addiction at bay.
Did you feel like that when you were an addict but not in recovery?
No, my first thought and only thought was, could I get drugs? Where could I get drugs? And as I said at the start, you know, I was so powerless that I put the drugs before everybody and anybody, you know. I put them ahead of my son, who I'm grateful. He's actually in another room just now. You know, and he's sort of grateful as well to have me back in his life, you know, because I was in and out of his life for 13 years. Yeah.
I've noticed a lot of people in my personal experience where, I don't know if they were using, they probably were using drugs, but I know definitely they were drinking. People are very offended by the world when you tell them you're an alcoholic. But nowadays I've noticed the kids, they love saying, I'm an alcoholic, as in it's cool and it's fun and it's hip, but they use it, I'm an alcoholic, for like that, because like they're proud of it, like it's funny. But 10 years or 15 years ago, it was an insult, and even an alcoholic would be like, no, I'm not. How dare you call me that? But then when they start going to AA, then they admit it. What is the difference there, do you think, psychologically? What's going on?
I think that the thing is, we sort of, for me, and this is just sort of my sort of take on it, is sort of alcohol sort of more acceptable, you know what I mean? Because it's legal for a kickoff. So it's not got that social stigma to it that drugs do, you know. But if you actually break it down, alcohol is a drug, and it's by far the most destructive drug out there, you know. It's more destructive than heroin, probably more destructive than crack cocaine, probably most destructive than crystal meth, which is, I know that's big in America, you know. So I think it's because it's more socially acceptable. People didn't have especially with young kids and stuff, like if they turn around to say to people, I'm a drug addict, you know, I didn't think it would get that sort of the same response as it does, oh, I'm an alcoholic. You know, so I think it's more to do with social,
Spot on. If you're online, you've probably seen it. Everyone's doing this. They're doing this with their drink and all this stuff. And I'm like, what is that celebration about? And I guess because I don't drink, so I do understand it. But at the same time, I don't understand. Yeah. You're flaunting a disease. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to be ashamed about, but you don't wear it as a proud either, you know? When does someone stop recovering? Can you, let's say if you're 25 years and you're sober, Can you still call yourself an addict in recovery?
Yeah, I think you're an addict till the day you die. And that's just my sort of belief in it. You know, whether you're 2 days in recovery or, as you said, 25 years, you know, and I think sort of that's sort of where things can sort of creep in, you know, when you get multiple years, I think complacency can set in, you know, and that can sort of maybe make a people who are long-term queen think, oh, I'm no longer an addict, I'm fixed now, you know. But I think if they start doing that, I think there's only one way they're going to go, and that's sort of to a relapse, you know. That's just my sort of experience so far, you know, because I've seen people 18 years clean, you know, sort of losing sort of their gratitude, the gratefulness for further recovery, you know, and sort of thinking, well, I'm 18 years, I've never touched a drug, I'll be fine now, I'll be all right, you know. And I think that sort of that's the two sort of expressions on how somebody feels. It's like the addict expression, you know, I'm fine, I'm all right, you know, as opposed to sort of elaborating on how they actually feel. You know, so I believe I'll be an addict till the day I die, and I'll be comfortable saying that I'm an addict till the day I die.
Wow. How does that make you feel? Because me, as a non-addict, I feel sad to know that I'll have to call myself an... I mean, sad, of course, I'm looking at it in a different glasses, yeah. And forgive me. I feel like I would feel sad feeling like I have a disease all my life that's not curable and I'm just managing it. And I'm just seeing it from a different glasses of a non-addict, so.
Yeah, but I mean, there's other diseases out there in the world that are sort of long-term and sort of, you know, you look at sort of people with cancer or people that have caught AIDS or HIV, they're stuck with that for the rest of their life, whether they like it or not, you know. So for me to sort of identify myself as an addict for the rest of my life, it's not going to kill me. You know what I mean? And I think we're sort of fortunate to be in the solution and not still out there in the problem, you know, sort of try to scrape money together to get another fix and stuff like that.
What made you join the group Addict Lives Matter?
I'd actually seen a couple of posts on that. In fact, I think I actually got sent an invite by somebody, or either that or I seen a couple of posts that people had put up, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to join that page because I'm on quite a few of the Facebook pages. You know, I'm on any recovery page, the local any page, the any just for the day page, and I'm on another one, and it's sort of a more fun sort of light page for addicts. You know, it's an addict humor and stuff like that. So I just thought, you know, addicts' lives matter, you know, because they do. You know, there's so many people out there that are still to find recovery. I didn't even know that recovery exists. I mean, I didn't find out about sort of NA until I was 39 years old. You know what I mean? Which is sort of, I mean, I know that the fellowships are really, really big over in America, and the United States are really massive over there. But so with me growing up and sort of through my using time and that, people didn't find recovery, they died. You know, they died, whether it be overdose or they went to prison or they just died, you know, for various different things.
Why do you think the person who created the group, let's say if it was you who would create the group, or why do you think that person calls the group Addict Lives Matter? Because that's like a whole, it's three words, but those three words mean a lot. Why? What do you think is behind those three words?
Well, I think sort of, and again, this is just sort of my own experience and stuff, but I think sort of people could sort of say, well, does all life not matter? But I think we addicts, because it's sort of so worldwide and sort of because addiction doesn't discriminate, you know, you could have the greatest upbringing in the world, doesn't make you immune to addiction. So I think that sort of that they three words are very, very powerful. And I think sort of what better way of carrying a message to sort of people who are just getting into recovery that I've got access to pages like that, you know, where people are sort of sharing their clean time, sharing sort of what's going on for them, you know, because I saw a few powerful pieces on that page, you know, that sort of, I mean, a girl sort of had been in active addiction for so, so long, crystal meth and stuff like that. And her sort of story, you know, I actually absolutely loved it, you know, and I sent the girl a direct message, a private message, you know, and sort of says to her, you know, that her story was really, really good. And it was just a brief sort of rundown of her thing. And I think it's important for addicts to have a forum on a page like Facebook, which is worldwide, and it can reach a lot of people. Because the thing is, I mean, all it would take is a newcomer just sort of maybe coming into one of the fellowships and reading a story like that. Because, I mean, sort of, they say in NA, if you stick around long enough, you'll hear your story. You know, and I think a lot of people reading the stories of addicts, where they were, how what they do now, I think it can inspire the next. Because, I mean, addiction is rife worldwide. And I think if we can inspire the new people coming in to ensure them that there is a new way of life, and if they do stick around, they can sort of turn their life around and stuff like that. I think it's really, really important. And I really, really do like that page.
What made you get sober in the last year and not before?
To be honest with you, I mean, I went to doctors for a long, long time and went to prison. And every time I would go to prison, I would always sort of say, right, that's it. I'm going to do it differently when I get out this time. And ultimately, because, I mean, I never had a problem staying clean in an institution, you know, like a prison or something like that, or in hospital. I could always sort of get myself together again. But as soon as I would get out of the places, I would be back on it within a couple of hours. I remember going to a doctor years ago who got one of my, a person I knew years and years ago clean, and I was like, how did you manage to get them clean, but you couldn't get me clean? And he actually broke it down to me so simply. He goes, it was his time, it wasn't your time. And I do believe that, you know, you find recovery when you're ready to. I mean, I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous via a hostel that I was staying in. Luckily, when I moved into that hostel through, so the last sort of year of my using was really, really dark. You know, I'd ended up being homeless on the street, begging, sleeping in a drying green in a stair, and sitting begging on the street, full of fear, you know, fear of being attacked, fear of being psychologically abused by people, so you know, you're smelly, begging bastard or whatever, you know. And then I got the chance to get into this hostel. And you know what? When I go into that hostel, I was like, I've got a chance here. There was a couple of people working in the hostel that were in recovery. But when I moved into that hostel, I bumped into an old using buddy. And fair enough, he wasn't on heroin anymore, but he was using crack cocaine. And I had smoked crack cocaine years and years ago. So I started dipping my toe back in, doing that. Then we got split up. And then it was actually a girl who was in the same flat as me in the hostel. She was like to me one night, do you fancy coming to a meeting? I was like, that a meeting? What kind of meeting is it you're going to like? She went, oh, it's just a meeting. Come along, you'll enjoy it. You know, because she could obviously see something in me. Because, I mean, I knew back then that I was an addict, but I had no idea about the disease of addiction. I mean, I just thought I had a drug problem. Went along to that first meeting, and to be honest with you, when I was at that first meeting, I didn't sort of take everything in, you know, but I heard enough that, you know, I thought, right, this is somewhere where I'll revisit again in the future. Left the meeting that night, went away and used crack, weed, and stuff like that, and that was, I think, October 2019. And then in January 2020, I said to that same girl, you know, I fancy going to another meeting. Went to that second meeting and picked up a white key ring, even though I wasn't clean. You know, I'm not going to sort of try and say that I was clean at that point. You know, but I had the desire because, it says in the any traditions, I think it's the third tradition three, that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. You know, and I think that that's important. You know, and I think it's really important for people who are still on prescriptions to sort of hear that sort of stuff. You know, because I think that maybe when people who are sort of suffering from addiction and stuff like that, or that fellowship, well, I don't know if I can join that, because it's all people clean, you know, but it's no, you know, and so anyway, I went to my second meeting, picked up a white key ring, and after about six or seven meetings, I then started to reduce, and, you know, on the 26th of November last 2020, I got clean. So, you know, it's been the last 14 months. I mean, I'm actually 14 months today. You know, wow. So I mean, I call that a higher power sort of moment today when you sort of messes me, you know, and sort of say, would you be up for doing this tonight? You know, I thought, you know what better day to do it on than my 14 month anniversary. So thank you. That's great.
Yeah, thank you as well. Happy 14th anniversary month day also. Wow. So is seeing a therapist part of going to AA? Is that offered? Are you currently seeing one?
No, I mean, I'd actually spoke to someone. This is actually quite a funny story. I was back around at the hostel I used to stay in. Because a member of the staff said, look, would you, because they actually do recovery meetings in the hostel, you know, because it is a hostel that sort of people, I mean, there's 30 residents in it, and I think all 30 of them are using a drug in one form or another, whether it be alcohol or prescription drugs or illegal drugs. So they asked me to go in and do a sort of share for them. I went in and sort of done that, and I was actually speaking to one of the cleaning ladies in there. This was a new cleaning lady that started after I had left. And she goes, have you never fancied going to see a therapist or a psychologist about what you suffer from? And that I said to her, I'm in a 12-step fellowship. I goes, I don't need a psychologist or a therapist to tell me what I suffer from, because I know myself what I suffer from, you know, and that is a self-diagnosis. That's sort of a realization I came to through coming into Narcotics Anonymous, that sort of, you know, that I know that I'm just like them, you know, the other people in the fellowship and stuff like that. And the way I deal with sort of the trauma that I sort of, not that I was physically ever abused, but from what I've seen growing up and stuff like that, the way that I sort of deal with that trauma is getting it written down in my step work, you know, and sharing it with another human being. You know, that's been sort of, and as it says, the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel, you know, and I didn't really like quoting the literature in the fellowships, but you know what, it's so true.
Mm-hmm. Why do people use the word clean, and how do you feel about that word?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, it's sort of strange, because obviously, you know, being in sort of, there's different fellowships, you know, and the two sort of biggest ones is AA and NA, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, I've had no problem saying I'm an addict, and I've got no sort of problem saying I'm clean. I even sometimes add in I'm clean and sober, you know, even though I get sort of frowned upon for doing so in any meetings, because in any in Scotland, I mean, I know in America, I mean, I've listened to, you know, umpteen American speakers, and they all come in and say, grateful to be here clean and sober, you know, but in sort of Scotland, frowned upon, you know, they're sort of saying, well, that's two diseases at work, where in NA, so you know, we only focus on one disease, which is the disease of addiction, which covers them all. But now I've got no problem saying I'm clean, because I think, again, for newcomers, you know, it's important that they sort of hear the words, you know, so if they've got, they can look and say, well, he's clean. You know, if I apply myself, I can sort of say, I'm clean, you know, whether it be clean and sober, clean, sober, you know what I mean? It's all one and the same. You know, we're all abstinent from whatever sort of drug we've put in our body. So I think it's important to identify ourselves as being that as well.
Have your friends and family talked to you that you reconnected with, talked to you about their process of not trusting you when you were using, and then their process of trusting you now, and how they feel about taking the leap of faith to trust you again?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like I said, I'd sort of burnt my bridges in my family, you know, and getting them back in my life. It was a process. It didn't happen straight away, the sort of the trust. I mean, I was sort of, I believe I was almost forgiven straight away, you know, and it was sort of, when I got to, I think it was around the 90-day mark, I went down to see my mum and my son, because my mum actually brings up my son, even though he's, I think he's 17, you know, and he still stays with my mum. And I went down to see her, and she was like that, you know what, Kenny, she goes, I thought I'd lost you. I thought that you were going to be on the drugs till the day you died. And she says, she goes, just keep doing what you're doing. I'm really, really proud of you. You know, and that sort of, that actually brought a tear to my eye, you know, to sort of just hear the three words, you know, I'm proud of you. You know, it brought a tear to my eye, because I was thinking, you know, what I put you through, you know what I mean? And yet you can still say now that you're proud of me for what I'm doing now. And even my wee boy, he's the same, you know, my son, he's the same. He's always, Dad, I'm so, so proud of you. Just keep doing what you're doing. And in terms of my gran, I mean, it was on the 9th of January, it was 5 years to the day since my granddad passed. And you know what? I was actually just reading over step 8 and the basic text. And I went to see her and we started talking about my granddad. And she was like that, you know what? She goes, Kenny, I'm really, really proud of what you've done and what you've achieved. Just keep doing what you're doing. She goes, and I know your granddad would be so, so proud. Yeah, and you know, I was like that, you know what, Grandma, I don't doubt my granddad's proud of me, I went, because my granddad can see what I'm doing now. And I sort of brought up the whole thing about the amends, and I sort of said, you know what, I can only make an amends to him indirectly, and that's an amends not to go back out there again and use, you know, that would be the biggest amends I could do for them. It's, in fact, it's probably the only amends I would really need to make to my family as a whole, you know, as a collect, would be to just continue to do what I'm doing and no go back out there into that chaos and madness.
Yeah. So it's good for you as well as your entourage. So that's win-win for everyone.
Yeah, win-win. Yeah.
I'm very so happy for you, Kenny. Wow. So how are you living your best life or yet?
Well, I mean, I guess, sort of, I mean, I'm content at what I'm sort of doing just now. You know, I attend regular meetings. I do service within one of the local committees for Narcotics Anonymous. I was actually the Where to Find coordinator, which sort of my job was to sort of get all the meetings listed, printed off onto leaflets and distribute them around. So that each meeting had X amount of leaflets to... Predominantly, they're sort of to be handed out to the newcomer, but anybody that wants to know where there's face-to-face meetings on in Edinburgh, I got them distributed, and I'm actually going for another service position because it's broken into two. I don't know how it works in America, but there's like an area which is it's Edinburgh and Lothian's area, but there's also a subcommittee called the Local Service Committee. So I do work for the Local Service Committee, but in January, the service positions come up because they're annually, but it's actually folded just now because nobody was willing to take on the chair position or the vice chair position. Also volunteer at the local treatment centre, even though treatment wasn't my route into recovery, you know, but I think sort of the ones that go through treatment, I think they sort of need to hear that, you know, because in reality, you know, with the treatment centre and with all treatment centres, they're right big up on their statistics. You know what I mean? If they've got an 80% success rate of getting people through treatment. But if you actually break it down to sort of the ones that once they leave treatment, do they go into a fellowship? Do they stay clean? You know, and I think that the numbers probably go down to about 20% of the ones that actually stay clean. And I think so it's important because ultimately treatment isn't for everybody. You know, some people can make a success of it, but I think it's important for people in treatment centres and stuff like that to find out that there is another way of doing things. And if I can pass on my experience, sort of the way I did it, you know, to people in treatment, then, you know, and if it can sort of convince one that maybe if treatment doesn't work for them to get back in the door and apply themselves to sort of the programme and stuff like that, then, you know, that would absolutely blow my mind.
Mm. That's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. And this has been an inspiring story to hear, and I'm sure you're going to inspire others. And I'm sure you have been inspired by other people that you've gone to meetings to, because your day one probably was, of course, new and different and nervous probably. And then you feel at home now because you had 14 months.
Yeah. Without a doubt, you know, and obviously it was the people. I mean, there's an expression that's used in Scotland. I mean, I don't know if it probably is used in America and stuff like that. And it's what they say to you when you get a day or two clean or whatever, get yourself into the middle of the bed. And I most definitely did that. You know, I jumped right into that bed and right into the middle of it. And I sort of kept myself in the middle of the bed for sort of 14 months, you know, and it's sort of, now it's so, I mean, I'm not feeling any pressure or that, but there's been a couple of people, you know, sort of in the fellowship and that saying, you know what, Kenny, you need to start giving it away. And I'd actually spoke to my sponsor about it, and he was like, that, what did you say to them? I went, well, I didn't really say anything to them. He went, well, what you say to them is, he goes, just tell them, if they say that to you again, that's between yourself and your higher power. You know, so I'm not going to feel pressure to do it. You know, ideally, I would like to get the rest of the steps done, and then, by all means, take on a sponsee or two, you know. But yeah, like I say, I'm just enjoying my recovery today. And
that's all the questions that I have today. Is there anything you want to say that I didn't ask before we go, so you can have your chance to say it?
Well, if anybody that's listening, will hear this podcast, you know, and if you're struggling, or you're on a prescription or still actively using, you know, get yourself, there's three fellowships out there, you know, I mean, get yourself to a meeting, you know, try all three if you have to, you know, and find the one that works for you. Don't delay things, don't put it off. Just get yourselves to a meeting of some sort, you know what I mean? You never know, it could change your life. I mean, I know it's changed minds.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you again for being here with us today and chatting and telling about your life, Kenny. Appreciate it.
No problem. I really, really enjoyed that. Thank you very much for asking me.
Yeah, totally. You're welcome.